The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Dr. Andrew Schotte now presents his lecture, Boost Your Resilience.
I want all of us to get into a time machine, and we're going to go back a few thousand years. It is 490 BCE. It's a very different world than the world that we have now. It's a Persian world, headed up by King Darius of Persia, and Darius wants Europe. So in 490 BCE, he loads 20,000 troops into ships and sets them a sail, landing them to the northeast of Athens. The Athenian generals have seen these ships go by. They correctly estimate 20,000 troops. They know they are hopelessly outnumbered. All they can summon is 9,000. They know they need help. They need help from their sister city, Sparta. So they call for Pheidippides. Pheidippides is a foot soldier, a private in the Athenian army, and he is a professional messenger. He's a runner. He's their fastest runner. And they dispatch Pheidippides to run to Sparta to get the help of their Spartan colleagues. He runs the 150 miles to Sparta across some of the worst terrain in Greece. He meets with the Spartan generals and they say, sorry, it's against our religion to fight until the next full moon. You're on your own. Now, most of us, even the most resilient among us, might walk back to Athens with that news, but not Pheidippides. He ran back the way he had come, another 150 miles. He tells the Athenian generals they're not coming. They know they have no choice. They must march out and meet the enemy, and they do. And under a blistering summer sun with Pheidippides in their ranks, they fight for the very survival of their city, for the very survival of their country. And at the end of the battle, a major upset. 9,000 Persians were killed in that battle, almost half their army. Only 190 Athenians were killed. It's a crushing defeat. The Persians rush for their boats. They're heading back to Persia. But then the Persian generals realize Athens is undefended and the Athenian land army is stranded on their battlefield. And they know they can get their fast ships to Athens before the Athenian army can make it back. They turn the ships around. The Athenian generals have seen it. They know they need to warn the people of the city that the Persians are coming. They again call for Pheidippides. Strip off your armor and run as fast as you can to warn the people of the city. He does, but the exertions of the last several days have taken a terrible toll. And after delivering the news, Pheidippides died of fatigue. Every year after, in his honor, the Athenian generals hold a foot race following exactly the path that he ran from the battlefield at Marathon, the 26.2 miles into the center of Athens. It became known as the Marathon. Now, I don't know how Pheidippides was able to do what he did, but as a psychologist, of course, I'm going to speculate. I believe he was empowered by a sense of love for his brothers in arms. I believe he was empowered the sense of love for his city and his country. I believe he was imbued with an insurmountable sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. And I believe that that was the font of his resilience. And for years now, I've been fascinated with how a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose can boost that resilience and how we can use the tools of resilience to get to that sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. And my question of you, and you don't have to reveal yourselves, no need to raise hands, but just ponder this. Where are you on your own personal journey to meaning and purpose? Have you arrived at the destination? You're loaded up with meaning and purpose more than you could possibly handle. You've gone a long way along the path, but you're not quite there. You're about halfway there. you've just started, or maybe you haven't even packed your bags yet for the journey. But wherever you may be, resilience is something that's going to help you get there. And when you get there, it's going to cycle back and fuel your resilience. My name is Andrew. I was born and raised in Australia. You've probably noticed an accent. I did my undergraduate work there. I started studying law, which is an undergraduate degree in Australia, but apparently that was too lucrative for me. So I shifted to a degree in political science, which was apparently too practical for me. I ended up graduating with a degree in philosophy, symbolized by the Greek letter in the top left corner. You can imagine my graduation party. Friends and family are gathered. My dad stood up to make the customary speech that dads make at a time like this, and he said out loud, "Son, I cannot believe that after so much time and money, you're actually less useful now than you were 4 years ago." It's a touching speech, I think you'll agree. I still tear up a little thinking about it. It turns out he was right. I ended up getting a job in the only organization in Australia that would have me, the Australian Federal Government. The Department of Social Security. And ironically, it was my job to interview people who'd been fired or downsized from their jobs and assess their eligibility for unemployment benefit. So for the first time in my life now, day in and day out, I'm meeting with hundreds of people who've been through great adversity. And I began to notice that some of them, I'm 20 years of age, got up, dusted themselves off, and went out to try to find another job. Whereas others, many, most, languished and became helpless and hopeless, and I became infatuated with the difference. I began to suspect that the key was psychology, symbolized by the Greek letter on the bottom left-hand side. I went back and did a second degree, this time in psychology, which led to a slightly nicer speech by my dad, and came to the States in 92 to get my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. I have been studying this concept of resilience now for 31 years. I never tire of it. I believe it is the single most important thing that we can do for ourselves and that we can do for our children. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about the link between having a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose and holistic wellness, because this is a retreat that is talking about spirituality and wellness. And spirituality, I believe, is made up of many, many complicated things, part of which is getting to that sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. I want to talk about some of the things we can do to use the skills of resilience to get into a good place, to be receptive for that meaning and purpose. And I believe that the first step is to quiet the mind. We need to be calm. We need to be in an emotionally good place to be receptive and open to what our individual meaning and purpose is going to be. I believe that we need to take care of ourselves. And I believe that in the last 3+ years, we've neglected that. And I believe that there are foundational thinking styles that get in the way of self-care. This is a mind-body connection. If the body is not healthy, the mind cannot be. And if you don't have that mind-body health, then being able to actualize that sense of meaning and purpose is extremely difficult. And then I want to talk about some of the work we've done specifically and directly about how we can boost meaning and purpose, what gets in the way of that, and then how we can help people get around those impediments. So that's the journey for us in our remaining time together today. Sound good?
Yes.
Fantastic. It's not as if we have a choice. The deck is set. But I appreciate the vote of confidence. So firstly, that purpose wellness link. This is just one study we've done in which we brought in 2,000 people who represented across the board in the United States of America, all of them employed in jobs. And what we did was we measured them using some instruments that we've developed on how developed their sense of meaning and purpose is. And we also measured them on a whole bunch of things that we care about in terms of holistic wellness, which is one of the reasons why we're all gathered here together at the retreat. And what we did was to divide the sample into four. Quartile one were those who were the lowest on their sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. Quartile two, the next 25%. and then quartile 3 from the median to the 75th percentile, and then quartile 4, those who are in the tip-top 25% on having developed a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. And this is just in terms of general physical health. You can see that with each step up in meaning and purpose, we see an advantage on physical health. We have the same kind of advantage when we look at days in hospital. We see the same kind of advantage when we look at the days that they were absent from their jobs each month. We see the same sort of advantage for impairment at work, presenteeism, as it's known in the corporate setting where I spend way too much of my time. And you can see that for each step up in a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose, we see less impairment of productivity. We see that in terms of general mental wellness, there is a superiority if we have a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. We see that the same is true in terms of psychological capital, which is one of the sophisticated terms we've developed, which just means hope, optimism, and resilience. And we see the same thing in terms of clinical stress as measured by the perceived stress scale. We see the same thing in terms of risk of clinical depression. It's big. It's really big. Now, developing a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose should be a goal unto itself. But the great news is it also bestows gifts that keep on giving. I want that for my children. I'm sure you want it for yours. I want it for myself, and I want it for everybody. So the first step is to quiet the mind. Quiet the mind. Calm those emotions. The mind is often not quiet, and I'm going to, with your approval and help, demonstrate that with this activity. I'm going to present you with a word jumble. Up here on the screen, you're going to see a word, scrambled letters. What I want you to do, if you would be so kind, is to unscramble the letters to try to find a word. There are a few rules I'm going to ask you to stick to. You've got to use all the letters that you see in coming up with your word. We're going to stick to words in English, if you would be kind enough to do that. And then finally, I respectfully ask that you keep quiet during this activity, to keep your thoughts to yourself. What will happen is you'll see a string of letters. You'll have a certain amount of time to solve them. They'll go away. New letters will come up. It's a word jumble. Everybody ready? Oh, I'm not feeling the love up here at all. Is everybody ready to go?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, you guys are great. Okay, here we go. New letters. That annoying sound will indicate we have new letters to try to solve. New letters. New letters. New letters. New letters. Ladies and gentlemen, only 225 to go. New letters. New letters. New letters. That was so, so kind of you to indulge me during that activity. Was your mind quiet? Did you have stuff fighting for attention in your head? Did you find that emotions were coming up for you? I wonder how many of you found yourself feeling at least a little frustrated during the activity. Take a look around. My work here is done. Thank you so much for having me. Frustration is an emotion that pops when we have thoughts that we don't have the resources we need to solve a problem. And many of you are probably thinking something like, if he just gave me more time, I'd be able to do this. I wonder how many of you found yourself feeling at least a little anxious during this activity, maybe even a little stressed. Show of hands, head nods, thank you. Very common response. And for those of us who did, we may have been thinking something like, I'm not getting any of these. And there's going to be another one and another one and another one. And we know that because anxiety is an emotion that pops when we have thoughts about future threat. And I wonder how many of you felt at least a little embarrassed as you went through this. Now, embarrassment, people don't like to raise their hand, so there's probably even more of you. It's a very normal response. And for those of us who fall into embarrassment, it's because we're having thoughts that go something like this. I'm not getting any of these. Everybody else seems to be writing something down. Am I the only person in the room who can't get it? What if at the end of this, Dr. S says, raise your hand if you got 9 right, 8 right, 7 right. I raise my hand for 0 and everyone will see, and I've got days left in this retreat. Spend with these people. And we know that embarrassment is an emotion that pops when we have thoughts that we will lose standing in front of others. Now, all very normal responses, but I've got something to tell you. These words were unsolvable. With the exception of regale. Did anyone get regale? Fantastic. Now, before I set myself up as being the grand word master, when we put this list together some 30 years ago, I didn't notice that regale was solvable. Very quickly, people pointed out, hey, idiot, that's regale. And I kept it in just for the fun of it. But why would I do this to you? A couple of reasons. One is, I had the great honor of teaching Psych 1 at the University of Pennsylvania for 7 years. And we had developed a resilience program for college freshmen. But no one who comes into an Ivy League school is willing to put their hand up and say, yeah, I'm not resilient and I need it. But if we gave this demonstration in week 1 or 2 of their first class at Penn and said to them, hey, everyone can benefit from this because we do not have quiet minds. And all of those thoughts that you had, I'd say to the class, how many of you were thinking, well, this just proves it. I was a big fish in a small pond in high school. I'm a little itty bitty fish in this big Ivy League ocean. I'm never going to make it. I'm going to get an average degree, which means an average job. That means I'll never have the success I want. I'll be unhappy because of that. If I'm unhappy, how could I ever attract a life partner? I'm going to die alone in poverty, living out of a dumpster. And at least 80% of these kids would say, I went a long way down that way. And then I would tell them, guess what? This drama was enacted only in your head. The noise in your mind was self-inflicted. And there are things that we can do to get to that quiet mind. And each and every one of us in this room has probably developed an emotion radar. I learned from my father to scan for violations of rights. Now I'm scanning for violations of rights. And I'm going to find a violation even if there's nothing there. And that will get me angry. And now I've had the great honor of handing this down to my son. So we want to help get around these radars. This is a quote that could be about the word jumble activity that you just did. It could be. It's not, but it could be. I've had a wonderful time, but this wasn't it. If we were all to get into a time machine again and go back a few thousand years, we'd be in a very different world than the world we have now. We would be in a Roman world. And were you born into that world and born not Roman, then you were automatically born enslaved, the Roman Empire. Epictetus was Greek. Greek born into this Roman world. As a young boy, his master was summoned back to Rome from Greece, and Epictetus was obligated to go with him as his property. As a young boy, Epictetus lost everything. family, friends, community, country, gone. He quickly learned that he had no control over his day. His masters told him what he could and could not do 24/7. But as a young man, Epictetus came to a powerful realization. As a young man, Epictetus realized that he and only he could control two things. That he and only he could control what he thought, and he and only he could control what he felt. And this brought about such a serenity in Epictetus that his masters noticed. They freed him. He went back to Greece and he founded a school of philosophy that we now know as Stoicism. And he wrote much that was profound, but in my humble opinion, nothing more profound than this. We are disturbed not by events, but by the views we take of events. We are disturbed not by events, but by the views we take of them. Here's what we've come to realize after 30 years of research on resilience. We develop styles in how we think about ourselves and our world and our future, the causes of our problems and our relationship with how the world should be. And those styles become hardened by the time we're about 10, 11, and 12 years of age. And they will put a ceiling on our resilience. And if we are to become more resilient, we need to understand them and get around them. And there's a particular variety of thinking styles that get in the way of keeping a quiet mind. They cause us to experience emotions when those emotions may not be warranted. This is a scenario I'm sure you can all relate to. It's the last 3.5 years. We know what we've been through. Every aspect of our life changed. If not forever, then at least then completely. The stress has been constant, if not accelerating. We've gone through financial uncertainty, workplace ambiguity, health concerns for ourselves and our loved ones. We've lived with social upheaval and political division. We've witnessed global strife, humanitarian crises, war. We've been on an emotional roller coaster. We've been through trauma. As a population, we are traumatized. And we all have different emotional responses to this. Some of us got angry because what we were thinking was, I need and deserve more support. I'm not getting it at work. I'm not getting it from my family. I'm not getting it from my friends. Violation of my rights to be supported at all times by all people. This is mine. And this is why I get angry a lot of the time. And some of us got anxious because we were thinking about things like, we're looking down the barrel of more and deeper change. It's never going to stop. We're going to go into an era of VUCA, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, as my friends in the Department of Defense would refer to it as. And this is about future threat. Some of us have developed a emotion radar in our childhood of scanning for where the next big hit is going to come from. If you scan long and hard enough for a violation of rights, you're going to find one, even if there's nothing there. And you're getting angry a lot of the time, even if the anger isn't justified. Aristotle wrote, getting angry is easy. Getting angry with the right person at the right time and in the right measure is almost impossible. Mark Twain wrote, there have been many catastrophes in my life, some of which actually happened. Many of us got frustrated during this time because we were thinking, I feel helpless to impact almost anything in my life. And many of us are still feeling that. Frustration is an emotion that comes up when we focus on the resources we do not have rather than the resources that we do. And for some people, this is not a one-off. They've developed a habit of scanning for the resources they need and do not have. And many of us got sad because we were thinking things like, life will never be the same again. And for some people, they tend to focus in the array of things in the environment on loss. And so sadness becomes a permanent partner in their lives, often unjustified. Maybe the loss is not permanent. Maybe it's not as global as they think it is. If you're anything like my wife, you went to guilt, because my wife would be thinking about things like, I can't protect my family nor restore any kind of sense of normalcy for them. And those people who experience guilt have developed a radar of scanning for how they may be violating the rights of another. Now, this is interesting because I'm an anger person who's scanning for violation of my rights, while my wife is a guilt person scanning for how she may be violating the rights of another. This works out quite well. A problem comes up, and she says, "It's all my fault," and I agree. Of course, that's not a sustainable strategy in a marriage. Some people go to embarrassment because what they're focusing in on is how other people can see that they're not able to cut it. Loss of standing in front of others. And we've seen an epidemic of shame. I had the great honor of working as a psychologist for 3 years in Japan. That's a shame culture. But we don't tend to do shame in the Western tradition. We do guilt, but we don't do shame. And there's a difference between the two. The great Greek philosophers, Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, pointed out that guilt and embarrassment are necessarily social. There has to be someone else involved for us to feel guilt or embarrassed. But shame can be a solo pursuit, because what we're thinking is that we're not meeting our own standards of how we should be in the world. And for some people, they find a way to make it through, because what they're thinking is, we'll sort this out. It's not good, but it's not bad either. And there's a few, a handful, a very small minority of people who find something to feel positive about. And they might be saying to themselves something like, this is a chance to reevaluate everything. And we saw this coming out of the Great Recession. We're seeing it coming out of the global pandemic. But unfortunately, not enough people are there yet. So what we encourage people to do to get to that quiet mind is to recognize that they're having an emotion, to be able to trap it. For me, it's going to be anger. I know when it's going to happen. It's going to be a hot red flush that comes up through my body, and I know that that means that my mind is not quiet. And I'll say to myself, you're getting angry right now because you must be having a belief that someone has violated your rights. What is that violation? I map it back to the radar. And then I say it out loud to myself. Here's an example. Some months ago, I was outside my house and I noticed something that really irritated me. And I came back into the house, stormed in. My wife, who was so used to this mood swing, didn't even look up from her laptop. But she said, "What now?" And I said, "You're not going to believe what our neighbor has done. You're not going to believe what Rick has done." And I heard myself say, "He's gone and parked his truck in front of our house again." Even as I'm saying it out loud, I realize if it's a violation at all, it's not a violation at a 10, which is where my anger was. So if we're going to quiet our minds, we need to realize that human emotions are real. They're valid and we're justified in having them. But we develop a thinking style called emotion radar that can lead us into emotions that are exaggerated, that aren't real, that are based on our perceptions and not what's happening. And unless we get to that quiet mind, we're not going to find that sense of meaning, mission, and purpose. And once we get that quiet mind, look what happens. In the work that we have done, where we've done time series analyses, we've worked with people just on getting around their emotion radars with Trap It, Map It, Zap It. We haven't done any other intervention with them. But just by improving their emotion control, we see these changes in their perception of the quality of their life, good versus bad events, physical health behaviors, work-life balance, engagement, productivity, and ultimately resilience. Self-care. Self-care. In June of 2020, with the pandemic only 3 months, 3 to 4 months in, I was saying to anyone who would listen, this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. This is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And finally, the chief human resource officer of a Fortune 500 company said to me, "Andrew, please stop saying that. Because it's not a marathon either. In a marathon, the gun goes off, you run 26.2 miles, and there's a finish line and it ends. There is no end here. We are going to be in change and ambiguity forever, and we need to reinvent our relationship with change. And that was eye-opening for me. It is an ultra marathon. Now, what that means is we need energy to spare. We need to be taking care of ourselves. If we burn out, then there's no way we're going to get to a place of meaning, mission, and purpose, nor are we going to be able to help others. As someone who works in industry, I know that the burnout rate in the Fortune 1000 under normal conditions runs at around 3 to 5% of their workforce. The Gallup organization recently released that 70% of the global workforce is showing significant signs of burnout. We're not taking care of ourselves. We're running out of energy. Burnout is what happens when the tasks that are required of us exceed our energy to do them. There are three modern truths I've learned over the last few years from people around me. It's okay to not be okay. Self-care is not a luxury, it's a necessity, but we have treated it like a luxury. I'll get more sleep on the weekend. I'll do more exercise in the new year. Self-care is not selfish, but I bet you that's a message that most of you are pushing back on right now. You're thinking to yourself, well, it kind of is. Self-care is kind of selfish. I had that conversation just this morning. The culprit here in terms of thinking styles are iceberg beliefs. Iceberg beliefs are big beliefs we have about ourselves and the world and how the world should be. We call them icebergs because only the tip is in our conscious awareness. Most of the iceberg is below the surface of the water. Most of the belief system is outside of our conscious awareness, but they are big, they are profound, and they have a major impact on our lives, and they're largely should and must. They come in three basic types. Some people have their icebergs mostly in the achievement space, some mostly in social, and some in control. And let me share with you examples of each. In the achievement space, we hear things like, being successful is what matters most. Failure is a sign of weakness. I must never give up. I should get everything right. Now, these are great. Right up until they're not. They're double-edged swords. I must get everything right drives us to excel. But perfection is an impossible goal. And those of you who have had kids, perfectionistic kids, know how detrimental that can be. And then some have it mostly in the social space. I want people to always think the best of me, avoid conflict at all costs. I should always be there for the people I love, avoid embarrassment at all costs. I should be respected by all people at all times. Wonderful. Makes you a wonderful human being. But it can be extremely self-defeating. We'll look at why in just a little bit. And some have it in the control space, and they were sorely tested during the pandemic when we were at the mercy of global forces that were largely outside of our control, and that tore them apart. And their beliefs like only weak people can't solve their own problems. I must always be in charge. Life should be fair. If you want it done right, do it yourself. Now, imagine this. Imagine that you have beliefs, icebergs in the achievement space. Being successful is what matters most. That keeps you at work. Now, if that's the only iceberg you have, your pathway is clear. Stay at work and neglect your family. Some people have icebergs. I should always be there for the people I love. If that's the only iceberg you have, your pathway is clear. Clock in, clock out, do as little as possible, and spend everything with your family. But most people don't. They have icebergs in both. And that means that they have an enormous amount of tension in their lives. And they are trying to be all things to all people, and they will burn out. And if you don't have that self-care, you can't possibly find your way to a sense of meaning and purpose. And if you throw control icebergs into the mix, I should be able to do it all. It is a recipe for disaster. So what we need to help people do is get these icebergs out. And I guarantee you that most of you in this audience have these caregiver icebergs. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here in the pursuit of greater things. You wouldn't be devoting your time and money and energy to this retreat if you weren't here because you cared. So you're probably loaded up on things like, it's my job to make sure people are happy. Sacrificing for others is the right thing to do. I can see by some of your wry smiles, most of which are into your hands, that many of you recognize yourself in these. We need to teach people a way to identify their beliefs and to be able to get around them so that we're keeping the best parts of these values, but not the parts that are hurting us. It's possible. We worked with medical professionals in North Carolina that were going through a Duke stress program. They loved it. They were in it for 2 years and they had no benefits. They were physically very unhealthy people. They knew what they should be doing and they weren't doing it. When you see that, you have to believe that icebergs are playing a role. We found their icebergs. I should be there for all people at all times. Sacrificing for others is the right thing to do. It's wrong to turn someone away. And what we wanted to do was to help them just build a little bit of a fence around those so that they're protecting themselves while they exercise these. This is what we found. Just by helping them create a better belief, a less childlike belief, like I should be able to do it all, which we developed when we were 10, 11, and 12, but doesn't work in an adult world. It's black or white. There's no shades of gray. When I think to myself, I should be supported and respected by all people at all times, I can almost see the 10-year-old me with my arms folded, stamping my foot. It's not intellectually nuanced, and we need to come up with a sophisticated, mature belief. And we see improvements across the board. In the time that we have left, I just want to revisit a sense of meaning and purpose. Here we are with Pheidippides. I had this interesting interaction in 2006 when I met a gentleman by the name of Steve. Steve was born in Waukegan, Illinois, a very frosty part of northern Illinois, extremely frosty. And these pictures were taken during the Waukegan summer. That shows you just how cold it can get. He told me his story. He said that he graduated from high school. He had college offers, but he didn't feel ready. So he got a job doing odd jobs on neighboring farms, plowing fields, mending fences. He said to me, "You know how it is, Andrew. You think you're going to do something for a year?" He said, "5 years later, I'm still sitting on a stupid tractor out in these fields." And he said, "One day I'm out there, it's minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit," which he described as brisk. And he... True story. And he said to me, in that moment, I knew I don't want to do this anymore. And in that moment, he realized what he really wanted to be. He wanted to be a rocket scientist. He's now the deputy director of NASA Langley. I said to Steve, "Why do you stay at NASA? You can make a lot more money in the private sector, get that golden parachute. Kids, family would never want for anything." And he looked me dead in the eyes and he said to me, "Andrew, I will never leave NASA, and here's why." He said, "Every day when I show up to work, I know that what I do contributes to the welfare of my country and the security of my nation." And right then and there, I knew that Steve Kraft was like Pheidippides, the first runner of the marathon, and he was going to be unstoppable. We then went out and did some concerted research around this. We ask people, what gives you the greatest meaning in life? Some people said, "I want the big corner office, the biggest salary I can get. I want the job title. I want to climb Everest." It was all individual goals. Others said, "Yeah, that stuff. But I also care about my family, nuclear family, extended family." You can see that that's getting a little outside of oneself. Others said, "Yeah, I've got these individual goals, and my family as well gives me meaning and purpose, but there's something else. I like to contribute to my community. I feel like that makes a difference." And yet others said to us, "Yeah, those three things, but there's something else. I just have this faith. I have this belief in God. I have a sense of spirituality. I have my religion. I have a value system that's not just mine, but is part of a larger organization that I'm a part of. The litmus test to get to that highest level seemed to be that they were connecting to something that was here before they were on the planet and would be here after they left. They were tapping in to a little slice of eternity. And what we found was that with each step up in that sense of meaning and purpose, we saw an advantage on wellness. And with each step up in that sense of meaning and purpose, we saw an advantage on resilience. Now, of course, this is research that we did in the mid-2000s, and I'm almost ashamed of it, because we should never have lost sight of the power and meaning and purpose. You know this story. He was prisoner number 119104 in a Nazi concentration camp, but before the war, he was a famous psychiatrist known throughout the psychiatry world. As you know, he and his family were rounded up and taken to separate death camps. He was the only member of his family to survive. He writes about a time as a medical doctor in the camp, watching men die with no ability to do anything about it. He writes so forcefully about the horrors of that camp. I have a tradition that every year around my birthday, I reread Will to Meaning and Man's Search for Meaning. Every time I do and I pick up that book, I'm shocked at the horror. How did anyone come out of that the way he did? I don't know. But he left us a message that unfortunately we forgot. And over the last decade and a half, we've tried to rediscover it. And the message that he said was, ever more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for. He who has a why can bear any how. For over 30 years, I've been passionate about the concept of resilience. I believe that we can get to a sense of meaning, mission, and purpose by deploying some of those skills to quiet the mind, to get around the icebergs that are preventing self-care. And I also believe that once we get to that place of meaning and purpose, then it is its own wellspring of resilience that can continue to sustain us. And I want to thank you so much for choosing this session and being with me today.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.